Hey everybody, I'm sitting here with Mike Murray. He is a registered dietitian, a certified sports nutritionist from the International Society of Sports Nutrition, and he has a CSCS degree. He currently runs a virtual personal training and nutrition consulting business known as Hammer Away, where he works with a variety of populations ranging from your college baseball players to your natural bodybuilders, and of course the general population. We're going to talk about intermittent fasting today and kind of the differences between diet and the endurance sports versus speed and power sports as well.
You're listening to the Science of Sports Recovery podcast. Each week we explore how to recover more efficiently from training so you can work out harder and realize your full potential. This is the Science of Sports Recovery podcast.
Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, man. It's a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Well, I want to get to a little bit of the athlete behind, you know, the dietitian and the nutritionist, because anybody who works in the sports science field or the sports performance field tends to have some sort of athletic background. So I'm just curious, like, what is that for you? The first sport, maybe, you know, third, fifth grade, what were you doing, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, growing up as an athlete, I basically did any and every sport. I mean, football, basketball, baseball, soccer. I was a swimmer at one point,
Oh, nice.
Which when we consider my current swimming ability, that's laughable that was, you know, part of my history as an athlete. But I ended up eventually more or less specializing in basketball and football. I was a pretty decent athlete in high school. And I eventually abandoned, you know, real sports for lifting weights because I was just more attracted to lifting weights, getting bigger and stronger. So I like the off-season training rather than the sport-specific training I was doing. And that eventually led me to competing in powerlifting. You know, as a junior lifter, I won a couple of state medals, like no big deal. It's whatever. I was a mediocre power lifter. And now all of my time is basically dedicated to improving as a natural bodybuilder.
Gotcha. It sounds like it was the kind of the act of doing it. And then the competition, it was like, hey, I'm already doing this anyways. Let's do, you know, compete in some things. Or did when you started, like, hey, I'm just going to lift weights, did you know that there was that competition kind of in the bodybuilding? And was that attractive to you right away, or did that come later?
Yeah, it was definitely attractive to me right away. I love competition in any and all forms. Yeah. Like, I'm kind of that dude who, like, oh, let's play a game of ping pong, and I probably take it a little bit too seriously. Yeah. So when I fell in love with lifting weights, I was basically like, how can I lift weights competitively? Mm-hmm. And that ended up becoming powerlifting and then evolved into now bodybuilding. So just like any opportunity to compete against other people, I'm in.
Yeah. What is there any crossover to like CrossFit, or is it pretty much just powerlifting?
Just powerlifting. Yeah, I would say it's very different from CrossFit in terms of the energy systems we're utilizing during our training sessions. That's for sure.
For sure. You're training into the, like, literally, you know, 1-2 seconds most full power, right?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of the PCR system, oxidative system, barely gets touched ever.
Yeah. cool. So then how, like, what was the transition from athlete? I'm sure obviously you're still an athlete, but into then helping other people with their nutrition and performance. Like, why did you go down that route rather than just going into, you know, a different job and continued training?
I appreciate you calling me an athlete. I'll refer to myself as an extreme hobbyist. I like, as a former real athlete, I don't recognize powerlifting and bodybuilding as like real sports. So basically, I ended up pursuing an exercise science degree early on in college, and I always knew that I wanted to pursue a bachelor's degree in nutrition following that and become a registered dietitian. Like, it's just, those things have always been my interests, and they stem from being an athlete and understanding that an understanding of exercise and nutrition science could optimize my progress as an athlete. So for those reasons, I was always really interested in those things, and it all just kind of connected. It all just made sense, and I really never had any other interests besides those areas and how they applied to me. And I guess you could say that helping other people was attractive to me, probably because coming up in lifting, in the fitness industry, there's just so much nonsense out there.
Totally.
Like, it's insane. I wasted a lot of time as a lifter, right? So in terms of like what was the best diet to follow for my needs and my goals, what was the best training system? There's a lot of bad information out there, and it's really difficult to sort through, right? Like, if you don't have a background in this, how do you know what's right? And often it just comes down to who's the biggest, who has the best performance, whatever that person is doing, I'm just going to follow along.
Exactly.
And that is pretty much never the right decision. I fell in love with the process of reading and learning more and everything else. Yeah. And frankly, there are a lot of people who love this stuff, but they have other things to do. You know, they don't work in the field. They have a family and kids, but they also want to get better. And they don't have time to sort through all the information and understand the science. And that's where I come in. I'm like, hey, I was in the same boat. So I'm happy to help you along and maximize your progress too.
Totally. Just because somebody who's really good is doing something doesn't mean that that is what made them really good, right? They could be good despite something. For instance, I tell this story a lot to people where in my high school career, I ran like 900 miles over the summer and was like ultra prepared for my cross country season, right? And I go to this like the biggest meet in South Dakota at the time, where all the schools are there. I get beat. I get second to this guy, and I ask him afterwards, like, so how, you know, many miles were you running this summer? And he's like, oh, I just kind of started when the season started, which was like 4 weeks ago. You know, so I put in all this work and still got beat. So, I mean, somebody talented like that could be doing something that's inhibiting their ultra performance, but still being ahead of you. So we got to keep track of that. So that leads me into like my first question here, where it's like, what's the worst advice that's mainstream that you hear over and over and it's kind of accepted as true, but you know, like, biologically it doesn't make sense?
It's a tough one. There are so many to pick from, to be honest. Considering my interests and me working professionally as a registered dietitian, nutrition is the first thing that comes to my mind. And with that follows the carbohydrate insulin model of obesity. So I'm not sure if you and your listeners will be familiar with this, but there's basically this camp within the nutrition science field that believes that carbohydrates in isolation are uniquely fattening. And this is because when you consume carbohydrates, there is a robust increase in the secretion of insulin. And one of insulin's functions as a hormone is to inhibit lipolysis, or the breakdown of fat. So they take this mechanism, which on paper makes a ton of sense, right? Mm-hmm. So if insulin is spiking throughout the day and you're eating a bunch of carbs, then you're not going to be able to lose fat. But in the face of this hypothesis, we literally have tons of controlled feeding trials on the topic. Kevin Hall is a researcher who put out a meta-analysis within the past 5 years on it, and he looked at 32 controlled feeding trials. So basically, these people were kept in a metabolic ward and fed all of their meals. So we knew exactly what they were ingesting, how much food they were eating. And within all this data, we saw that when you equate for total calories and protein content, because you do burn some energy digesting protein, when you control for these two factors, there are no differences in weight/fat loss between groups.
Wow.
Yet some people still kind of run with this hypothesis because, again, on paper, it makes sense. But we have longitudinal data showing, as much as it makes sense, it doesn't pan out in the real world.
Yeah, so those groups were split into, they had like higher or the same caloric intake and then different levels of protein versus carbs. Is that what you're saying? Or how was that split down?
So protein was held constant. The only thing that differed was the amount of carbohydrate and fat in the diet.
Okay.
So fat has little effect on insulin, whereas carbohydrate ingestion has a robust effect.
Sure.
So we're looking at vastly different levels of insulin secretion throughout the day by manipulating fat and carbohydrate.
Sure.
But despite that, there's no differences in fat loss.
Sure. Well, what about like energy from, you know, carbs versus fat? We hear that a lot in athletes where, you know, fat's a better source of energy in the longer endurance sports. Mm-hmm. Carbs, you know, is more of probably your lifting, short sprints, those kinds of stuff. Do you see any misrepresentation when it comes to that recommendation?
Yeah, I would say so. There is, I would say, a growing community of people. You would know better than I would when it comes to the endurance world, like what's going on in terms of the current trends.
Sure.
But from what I'm aware of, there are people who, when it comes to endurance sports, they tend to edge on the side of a very high fat, very low carbohydrate diet because of the ability to use fat for fuel.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, when we look at the research on the topic, like it's extremely clear for endurance sports that when you limit carbohydrate consumption, performance is impaired.
Yeah.
And obviously, high-intensity performance is impaired. But also, when we look at time to exhaustion or just rating of perceived exertion for the same level of activity, there are these clear decrements in performance, and everything just feels way harder. Now, I know there are a couple of papers looking at like ultra-endurance events, so things that are just insanely long,
yeah,
where there's more or less no, like, there is an absence of high intensity, right? Because, like, I mean, you can run, you know, a few miles, but the intensity is going to be relatively high, and there's going to be portions in that race, right, where you're going to crank things up.
Yeah.
And for those periods, you're going to need to be able to utilize some carbohydrate. So, for pretty much all endurance sports and anything that relies on anaerobic metabolism, carbohydrates is definitely the way to go, and I don't think you would see many professionals argue with that.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some plausibility when it comes to the insanely long stuff to follow some sort of very low carbohydrate diet. But again, I think it's definitely debatable. Like, it's not a super robust body of evidence. And I'm sure we'll get into this later, but then this brings into the question of periodically using, you know, a very low carb ketogenic diet for endurance sports. And that's another thing. There's some interesting data. But again, we'll probably come down there later in the discussion.
Sure, sure. Well, let's get into one kind of trend or macro trend, I guess you might call it, of intermittent fasting. Because I've heard the pros, I've heard the cons on it. So I'm curious on your point of view. First of all, intermittent fasting, you know, 30-second rundown of what that actually is, and then, like, what is the proposed purpose of it, and then we'll get into what actually happened.
So, I think it's essential here to start with a background of intermittent fasting, and maybe your listeners will know what it actually is, but in practice, in the media, I find that not many people know what intermittent fasting is. So, intermittent fasting is not a diet. It is an umbrella term that encompasses multiple different strategies, right? So intermittent fasting can be divided into three branches. One is alternate day fasting, which cycles between days of ad libitum eating with days of either complete or modified fasting. And modified fasting typically looks like a day of about 500 calories total. So that's alternate day fasting. Then we have periodic fasting, which refers to anything from two complete or modified fasts per week to as little as one complete or modified fast per month. And the most popular iteration of this is the 5-2 diet. So the 5-2 diet encompasses 5 days of ad libitum intake per week, interspersed with 2 days of modified fasting. So again, that's just the most popular form of this.
And when you say ad libitum diet, does that just mean normal eating, or what do you mean there?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So ad libitum means no restrictions. You eat, and you eat as much as you want of whatever you want.
Okay.
And then the last branch of this tree of intermittent fasting is time-restricted eating. So when you hear someone talk about intermittent fasting, they're usually referring to time-restricted eating, which is really a subcategory of this general term.
Gotcha.
So time-restricted eating includes an extended fasting period longer than your standard overnight fast. So this can range from limiting your daily eating window from anywhere from 4 to 12 hours. And the most popular form of this is 16-8. So that's a 16-hour fast interspersed with an 8-hour eating window.
Okay. So what would be, first of all, liquids outside that window, are typically, say, sports drinks or something that wouldn't be just water, is that allowed outside the window, or is just outside, the time window, whether it be alternate days or, time restricted, are you just drinking water?
Yeah, so in the quote-unquote fasting period, it is exclusively beverages that don't contain any calories. So
gotcha.
That's probably going to be water, but that could also be tea or coffee without any of the additives on top.
Okay, cool. So what is the proposed benefit of intermittent fasting?
I like how you phrase this question, because it is these are proposed benefits, which we'll end up coming back to. So the first thing that you'll hear about is this term autophagy. You'll hear, intermittent fasting upregulates autophagy, which is great for health. So autophagy is a general term that could be described as cellular housekeeping, right? So there are many forms of autophagy, but each relies on lysosomal degradation. So in this process, a lysosome engulfs cellular proteins, organelles, and the like, and then eventually fuses with a lysosome, which degrades these contents and recycles them. These are things that are no longer needed and or dysfunctional, so we can break all these things down, get rid of them, and use the remainders for things that we actually need to do. So this is a process that has been conserved throughout evolution as human beings. It was critical in past times, right? When we as humans experienced food shortage and we needed to produce energy to survive and to enable us to perform physical activity like hunting or running away from predators.
Sure.
So this is an essential process that we need. And why would we want our diet to increase autophagy? Well, there is a pretty sound body of evidence showing that impairments in autophagy are associated with adverse health effects and disease, just overall unhealthy aging. But there's nothing special about intermittent fasting when it comes to the process of autophagy. So autophagy is an energetic dependent process. So anything that stresses energy systems is going to upregulate autophagy to a degree. So there's actually a really robust body of evidence showing upregulations in autophagy with plain old calorie restriction. However you do it, restricting calories is going to upregulate autophagy.
Okay.
And this body of evidence is definitely more consistent than the intermittent fasting body of evidence. So someone might hear that and say, but intermittent fasting increases autophagy more, right? And it's like, no, that's not the case. You wouldn't be able to say that based on the evidence.
Sure.
And then also, exercise acutely upregulates autophagy. And this has been shown in multiple studies with endurance training, cycling of at least 60 minutes at a VO2 max of 55 to 70%. We see these upregulations in autophagy. So that is the first proposed benefit.
Okay.
Do you have any questions before I get to the second? There is only two.
Yeah. Could you just like explain autophagy without getting into the lysosome and cellular terms? Just if somebody kind of got lost in there, just maybe a 15-second overview of what autophagy is.
Yeah. So just generally, cellular housekeeping process, right? So we have these specific cells in the equation, but ultimately we're just getting rid of things in the body which are no longer needed.
Gotcha.
For us to function. So we're getting out the stuff that, you know, is dysfunctional, and we're rehashing things in the body, if that makes
perfect
sense generally.
Yep, that's perfect.
Okay.
So let's get on to the second proposed benefit.
Okay. So the second proposed benefit is basically extended periods of fasting result in changes in substrate utilization. So basically, you go from being reliant on glucose from the carbohydrates that you eat to relying on fat. So we see these elevations in free fatty acids and ketone bodies mm-hmm. in the blood. And then with this reliance on glucose, we see concomitant reductions in insulin. And this is just a basic physiological fact, right?
Yeah.
Like, we need to get fuel from somewhere. And if we're not getting anything coming in, then we're going to break down stores in the body
yeah.
to fuel our activity, to fuel our existence. And I wouldn't say there's anything magical about this. It just is. But you'll hear a lot of, you know, theories and proposed mechanisms on how this could bolster health, but I wouldn't say we have any, you know, direct evidence to really support that in humans.
If you stick around and listen to enough of our episodes here on the Science of Sports Recovery podcast, you'll notice a common theme of importance of mobility in recovery and injury prevention. That's why I recommend checking out the Ready States Virtual Mobility Coach to help you improve your mobility, recoverability, and injury prevention. The Ready State is a brainchild of coach and athlete Dr. Kelly Starrett, who you can learn more about on episode 13. His Virtual Mobility Coach program helps athletes understand the importance of recovery, pain relief, and self-care. In other words, it helps fix the recovery side of training so you can keep seeing results from your workouts. His program will guide you through the same mobilizations used on athletes in the NFL, NHL, and MLB, provide custom tools for pain relief, give you customized pre and post exercise mobilizations based on your training and sports schedule, and deliver daily mobilizations to keep you on track to achieve your goals. You put your heart and soul into your workouts. Make sure you get the most of them by going to thereadystate.com/Jace. Again, that's thereadystate.com/JASE. The link will also be in the show notes. Now, back to the show. Sure. Okay, so the second one, basically, you're utilizing the fat stores rather than the glucose and stuff. Okay. So then what does in your experience, what does the science actually say about these two proposed benefits? Like, is intermittent fasting the best way to do it? And do they actually, you know, sustain long term and have benefits that we want, whether that be weight loss, performance, those kinds of things? And I know you touched this in the autophagy. Like, is there other ways to get it besides intermittent fasting?
Yeah. So for autophagy, again, you can get that through plain old energy restriction. So no matter how you structure it, if you, you know, have an energy deficit in place, there's going to be increases on autophagy. And really, when we look at the overall body of evidence for longevity and a healthy lifespan, caloric restriction is just consistently shown to be a part of the healthy aging process. And then there are acute upregulations in autophagy with, you know, moderate intensity aerobic exercise for relatively long durations. There's not as much long-term data on how exercise affects autophagy long-term, but it does seem plausible that these acute upregulations would lead to long-term benefits. So when it comes to the science of intermittent fasting and how that compares to other strategies, it doesn't look too great in the literature, to be completely honest. So when we do see a benefit of intermittent fasting, you know, whatever strategies employed from those three branches mm-hmm. that I referred to earlier, when it's compared to continuous calorie restriction, we really don't see any differences between groups when it comes to cardiometabolic risk factors or any other markers that we're interested in. And then the studies that do show benefit of intermittent fasting are usually confounded by weight loss, right? So it's like, oh, did you see that this study on time-restricted feeding or alternate day fasting improved glycemic control, or it improved the lipid profile, it reduced LDL cholesterol? Like, isn't that fantastic? And it's like, well, you look in the results and it's like, yeah, but the subjects using intermittent fasting lost 5 kilograms, right? And we know that basic weight loss is going to improve all of these things simply because of that. So we can't say it's because, oh, they utilize an extended fasting period. So overall, it doesn't look too good. There are a couple of studies that show there might be unique benefits on insulin sensitivity, but again, it's like two studies in a very large body of evidence, so we can only take so much from that. And I will say that it's a very specific form of intermittent fasting where we see those improvements, and that's early time-restricted feeding. So in these studies, people are utilizing a limited feeding window, but they're ceasing energy intake by 2 in the afternoon or 4 in the afternoon. And, you know, we might see improvements in insulin sensitivity with this mm-hmm. approach, but I haven't worked with anyone who can stop eating at 2 p.m. every single day. That doesn't tend to fit many people's lifestyle.
Yeah.
So when we see like these just very slight improvements with this approach, it doesn't seem to be worth the trade-off, right? So overall, it's a really fascinating area of research, particularly early time-restricted feeding mm-hmm. seems to show some unique benefits, but most trials that see benefits are confounded by weight loss. And when you compare intermittent fasting to just good old energy restriction, you know, a 25% energy deficit on a daily basis, we really don't see any differences in outcomes.
Gotcha. So potentially, if you're there like, hey, I don't want to count my calories, I just want to do, you know, not eat at these times, you could get some of the same benefits when it comes to weight loss as, you know, caloric restriction. Is that kind of what you're saying? Or is it still, hey, they're eating the same amount of calories as this person from the caloric restriction? It's just in this certain time window, and that's why they're also losing the weight. Do you understand what I'm asking there?
Yeah, I do. Okay. And it's a fantastic point, to be completely honest. So when I think about, you know, the magical properties of intermittent fasting, specifically time-restricted eating, mm-hmm. I wouldn't say there's any physiologically magical about it, but there have been multiple studies showing that if you just restrict a person's eating window, so somebody comes to you, you look at their food diary, and you see they're eating over like a 15-hour period, if you just tell them, hey, pick an 8-hour eating window of your choice, and that's it, do whatever else you want, we see that it typically leads to subconscious decreases in energy consumption. So they'll just lose weight without even trying.
Sure.
And for that reason, you know, intermittent fasting, time-restricted eating can be a useful approach for those interested in fat loss if they really have no interest in tracking calories or doing anything else. Just say, hey, shorten your feeding window, pick an 8-hour window that works for you. And there's a good chance, based on the data, that person will just end up losing weight, which is, you know, really practical, right? Which matters.
Yeah. It's something that's really simple, easy to follow, because it's like, hey, well, I can't do this, you know? If you get a bunch of those, like, time lockers, you could put all of your food in those where you can't get to it for 8 hours or whatever. Okay, so here's the million-dollar question. When it comes to intermittent fasting for athletes, is there any point when an athlete should consider intermittent fasting?
Overall, I would say probably not. So as we just touched on there, if an athlete maybe needs to drop a little bit of weight, maybe they're a weight class restricted sport athlete, you know, sure. a wrestler or whatever. And again, maybe they don't feel like tracking calories. Be like, hey, you know, try implementing this and see if it works for you. In those cases where an athlete needs to lose a little bit of weight, this might be a super practical and effective approach for them. But for the average athlete who should be concerned with fueling their daily activities and fueling their recovery, right? Shortening your eating window, having less opportunities to eat, typically isn't the best idea.
Yeah. Okay. Totally agree. And that's awesome. Okay. So let's get into misrepresented foods, because I know in the nutrition world, it's like, you know, coffee is the best one day, the next week it's the worst, you know, coconut oil is the best, now it's, you know, horrible for you, bananas are, you know, superfood and whatever. What do you think, like, currently is a misrepresented food in the bad way, meaning mainstream thinks that it's a healthy food, but it might not actually be as healthy as one thinks. And we'll get in the reverse side of that too.
So do you want me to talk about food specifically or macronutrients that tend to get demonized as a whole?
Let's go both. Start with macro and then examples of some foods.
Okay. Starting with macronutrients, all of them? Like, I'm being completely serious. Like, I'm very involved when it comes to nutrition on social media and just, like, the most recent publications that are coming out on the topic. And you can find a diet camp for any macronutrient that just completely despises it, right? We can go to those sure. who subscribe to a ketogenic diet, and they basically blame carbohydrates as a whole for the current obesity epidemic. We can look at protein, and there's like a segment of the vegan population that thinks protein is the devil and just like the cause of yeah. chronic disease. And even in my education, you know, I heard from many different registered dietitians and nutritionists about how, yeah, protein's good, but, you know, don't overdo it. Because, you know, X, Y, and Z might happen. There are a lot of fallacies surrounding protein, which have no evidence to support them. And people are just kind of behind on the science on it. And they'll continue to say, you know, make sure you don't eat too much protein because it will damage your kidneys yeah. and make your bones brittle. And these things are just completely untrue. And then we can also look to fat. And, you know, and people will say that, oh, you know, you eat fat, you get fat.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter where you turn, you can find a substantial group of people who thinks one of the three macronutrients
yeah.
is absolutely evil. And I would be curious from you, your experience as an endurance athlete, like which macronutrient tends to get the worst rep?
I think fat, to be honest. I think people focus on carbs and they focus on protein, and then fat kind of takes a back seat, where in my like opinion of this, and I'm not a registered dietitian, I haven't taken yeah. the nutrition courses, but I do read and stuff, like my philosophy when it comes to nutrition is I don't really even focus on macronutrients or even micronutrients in silos, because I think that's kind of a misnomer of what food actually is. It's like, you know, looking at my hand, and if my hand was broken, saying I'm a broken person, right? Because I'm not just my hand. Food is not just carbs. It's not just proteins. So I look at where like the food comes from. That's kind of my philosophy. But I think overall, carbs are like what everybody talks about, is like, you need carbs before you run. You need carbs before you run. And, you know, it's like, well, okay. And then the protein is like, this is how you build muscle. And then sometimes that can be in the endurance, like, oh, don't get too much muscle or don't get too much protein because you don't want to put on the muscle mass. And I'm like, that's not really what's going to happen. But yeah, that's from my experience in the endurance world, what the conversation kind of is like.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And yeah, I would say I guess if I was to like really generalize things, you know, people who aren't interested in nutrition whatsoever, like what macronutrient they might put their attention on, and it's probably carbs, right? Like that's probably the most common one that gets the blame. You know, if you want to lose weight, what's the first thing you should do? Cut carbs. There you go. Yeah. Like that's like the best strategy and everything. And I mean, it's completely untrue, right? Like as we talked about, like controlled feeding trials on topic, like you can definitely lose, you know, a ton of fat eating a high carbohydrate diet.
So I'm curious to your thought. I kind of introduced the topic, but on like, is it even worth it to pay attention to like protein intake versus carb intake versus fat or these micronutrients, or is it better to just focus on like having a mixture of food, you know, where it's coming from? Like, what are your thoughts on overall food and maybe caloric intake versus, you know, trying to break down each nutrient and getting the right ratios?
Yeah, so I think this is like a long-term process for athletes. And I think you start with training wheels, and you should start with training wheels. You shouldn't just immediately hop on the bike. An athlete needs to have a general understanding of what they need to fuel their performance and their recovery. And in the early stages, I think it can be beneficial for them to not only have basic nutrition education, right? Like what are carbs, what are fats, what are protein, but to spend some time tracking those, because we do have some data showing that, hey, depending on your training volume, you probably need at least this many grams of carbs per day to fuel your performance, right? And in my practice as a sports dietitian, when I get an athlete, 9.5 out of 10 times, it's somebody in high school who wants to play college ball, or it's a college athlete that wants to take it to the next level. And what's the limiting factor for them in most times? It's their size. They're just not big enough. They don't have enough muscle. And in these cases, it's people who just, they don't chronically undereat. You know, they're meeting their energy needs, but they're meeting their energy needs for a very small body size. Mm-hmm. And basically, they're matching their hunger and their energy expenditure with their energy intake. And it can be a part-time job eating for these people to put on weight. Totally. And, you know, I need to help. I find that it's critical for me to help them understand how much food is going into their body on a daily basis, because I get these kids in high school and they're like, man, I eat everything. Their parents are telling the same thing too. They're like, this kid eats everything. He never stops eating. He eats 6 times a day.
Yeah.
And I will get 2 weeks of food journals from them and they'll be eating 2,500 calories. And I'm like, so for you to make the progress that you want to fuel your activity, I mean, we probably need closer to 4,000. And they're like, what? Like, and it's like, yeah. Like you're an athlete and you're in high school. Mm-hmm. And so your expenditure is through the roof. You're still growing. Like eating becomes a part-time job. So it's really essential for them to get those basic components and understand these things. But then once you master the basics of nutrition, you get an understanding of how much you need to eat to fuel your activity. Then I think it's more appropriate to get away from the nutrition tracking app and all of these metrics that people can obsess over, you know, the right ratios, the right foods and this and that. Once you get the basics, I think you need to deviate from those specifics, and you should, because ultimately, you know, disordered eating behavior and eating disorders are really prevalent in sports, especially when it comes to weight class restricted sports. Right. And when we look at the literature, when it comes to tracking your food, tracking your exercise, and all of these numbers that people can become insanely obsessed over, it's only going to exacerbate those issues. So we need to really do a better job of assessing our athletes at baseline, understanding where they're coming from with their relationship with food. And that will determine, you know, first, whether we should worry about all these details with them. And if we really should, then we need to get them off of that as soon as possible, right?
Gotcha. Yeah, get them to a point where they, it's kind of second nature, where like, hey, I know I need to eat more because I mentally, I just, you know, had this throughout the day, and I can attest to your athletes who are like thinking they eat a lot and then finding like I'm 1,000 short. I started doing this, so I ran like 100 miles a week at some points in my career, and you know, obviously you burn a lot of calories doing that, and being a college athlete, just in, you know, kind of the way the body, being a male and being active, you know, you burn a lot of calories anyways. And then, you know, on top of that, running so much, I was under eating like all the time. And I literally had to stuff myself like every meal and multiple, you know, times, 4, 5, 6 times a day to get the caloric intake. I just didn't know, because I was like, I was eating till I was full, but I wasn't eating to being, you know, on that energy, out of that energy deficiency. So I think that's a good point that you bring up there as well. But
are you familiar with REDS, relative energy deficiency in sports, or formerly known as the female athlete triad?
We've actually had a few guests in the past talk about it, yeah.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, like I was just going to say that in terms of this whole fueling conversation and matching with your experience, like we have a number of studies looking at the prevalence of this, and there are some issues with how we track energy expenditure and energy intake. So yeah, there's some inaccuracy in this. But on average, when we look at collegiate athletes and even some professional athletes, low energy availability falls in the range of like 25 to a little over 50% in certain populations, like elite soccer players. It can run in about half of the athletes in that population. So when it comes to underfueling, it's a huge problem, and it's really important for athletes to understand, you know, how much they need to function optimally, right?
Yeah, and I would say that you asked earlier about you know, which nutrient gets the bad rep in the endurance world. I think it's probably eating too much gets the bad rep, because we're so concerned not putting on weight, right? Because if you have to haul your body for an hour and a half, you don't want any extra muscle mass or fat mass than you possibly can. So then we don't eat as much, and then we're underfueled, and then that leads to more problems down the road. So as far as are all carbs created equal, or fats or protein? And what I mean by this is you can eat a bag of potato chips, right, and get a certain amount of carbs, and you can have vegetables that have, you know, a certain amount of carbs. Like, is... talk to us about, like, what's the difference between those when it comes to fueling?
Yeah, so when it comes to individual foods and what they provide the athlete, like, yeah, there are differences. You know, a piece of white bread is not the same as a bowl of quinoa, right? So we might be able to get 50 grams of carbohydrate from both of these sources, but the quinoa is going to provide more fiber. Considering the whole grain is intact, there are some beneficial plant compounds in there, which can get removed in the refining process to make something like white rice, you know, compared to brown rice. Mm-hmm. So there's some good stuff in there. And then just from an overall micronutrient profile, so the vitamins and the minerals are going to provide, as well as fiber, which has a whole host of health benefits. All sources aren't created equal. And for that reason, I do always try to emphasize with my athletes, you know, making better food choices. Because again, I have a lot of high school and collegiate athletes, and they're not too concerned about food quality, right? Like, especially in college, like you hit up the cafeteria and, you know, there's pizza and burgers and fries. You're like, of course I'm going to eat this. This stuff's so tasty. Like, why would I pick something else?
Exactly.
So, but at the end of the day, like, we have these basic needs we need to meet as humans, right? Like, there is a certain level of vitamins and minerals that we need to get each day. There's probably a minimum threshold for fiber that we should reach if we're also concerned with maximizing our health. But to that point, I would say that this whole equation functions on a bell curve, right? So it's like, okay, we need to make sure we're getting enough vitamins, minerals, and fibers. But then once we reach those targets, we're not getting any additional benefits from that,
sure,
right? So what I like to do with my athletes is to really emphasize these minimum thresholds that we should be meeting each day, right?
I like that.
So maybe have a fruit or a vegetable with each of your meals, right? Average athletes eat 5 to 6 times a day. 5 to 6 servings of fruits and vegetables, beautiful. We know there's all sorts of robust health benefits associated with that. But once we get up to 10, it's probably not necessary, and any gains from that are going to be associated with adverse consequences in athletes, right? If they eat that much fiber from vegetables and fruits, they're going to be bloated, they're not going to feel good, and they're not going to perform well. So yes, there are obvious differences between foods, but once we get those fundamental, foundational, healthy foods in, throw some chips in, throw a couple of Gatorades in, because at the end of the day, we have exorbitantly high needs for overall energy that need to be met, or we're going to have these consequences when it comes to relative energy deficiency in sport and just like the host of negative side effects that coincide with that.
Totally. I love that concept of minimum thresholds. And I think that gives them, like, you look at supplements, which we won't go down this road, but you look at, you know, vitamins, minerals, supplements that have, you know, exorbitant amount of different minerals and stuff in them. And you find all these studies that, like, the average population is affected this much by it. But then you try to take that into the athletic world and you don't see the results as you do in the general population. I think this is the reason. It's because the athletic world tends to pay attention more to, you know, how they're eating already. And that's really what causes, you know, because they're getting their minimum thresholds, whereas the general population might not be. And that's why you see that effect there and not in the athletic world. I'll let you comment on that, but then we have to wrap up and tell people where to find you.
Yeah. Only thing I would say is, and then we also have to consider just how much they're eating overall, right? So again, this idea of minimum thresholds is really important. But at the end of the day, when you're eating 5,000 calories, it's going to be rare that you're just severely lacking in a specific micronutrient. Like, sure, you're just eating so much that we're probably going to cover all of our bases regardless.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. So where can people find you, connect with you on social, listen to your podcast and website?
Yeah. So the best place on social media is probably Instagram. And you can find me at Hammer Away Fitness. I also have a website, hammerawayfitness.com. And then my podcast is called The Muscle Memoirs. And you can find the video content on YouTube. Just Google The Muscle Memoirs. And it's available on all major podcast apps. So Apple Podcasts, Spotify, so on and so forth. And you can check me out there and we can connect.
Awesome. Well, I'll have links to your Instagram, your website in the show notes, and then your YouTube channel as well. We'll all be in the show notes. So Mike, thanks so much for being on the show today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. All right, episode's over. If you found value in this episode, please consider giving us a review on iTunes. And if you haven't already yet subscribed, do so now so you don't miss any important topics in the coming week. And if you have any questions or suggestions for the show, please send them my way. I am most responsive on Instagram. That's at jcheese, J-A-E, cheese, like the food, or email me directly at jase, J-A-S-E, at scienceofsportsrecovery.com. Talk soon.